print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Patricia Mary, and for the next hour, I will be reading from the Saturday-Sunday issue of Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And that Saturday-Sunday is July 25th and 26th. From the front page of Off Duty, inside the push to make paddle the next pickleball. Paddle, P-A-D-E-L, a cousin of squash and tennis, has showed signs of becoming the next American sporting sensation. Entrepreneurs, from fashion executives to coffee chain founders, are looking to cash in. And this is by Andrew Zucker. For much of the 20th century, the Delaware Power Station in Philadelphia provided electricity to the city's residents and businesses. Completed in 1923, the power plant closed in 2008, leaving the main turbine hall of its beauty arts building abandoned until last year, when it became a place to play paddle. The 55,000 square foot hall, lit by gaping skylights in the 75 foot high ceilings, reopened last November at Spallers, a sports club that has three glass and mesh enclosed paddle courts, along with golf simulators and courts of squash and pickleball. The real anchors are the pickle and the paddle, says its founder, David Gust, a 50-year-old former Equinox executive. The Philadelphia Ballers now have some 700 members who pay between $110 and $457 a month. David has also opened a Ballers in Boston and is now developing a Los Angeles location. Last year, paddle drew 1 million players domestically, according to the U.S. Tennis Association, which began tracking participation in the sport in 2025. U.S. Paddle, again it's spelled P-A-D-E-L, the sport's governing body in America, reported that its club and individual memberships grew by about 50% year over year in 2025. Across the country, entrepreneurs like David are capitalizing on the interest by retrofitting unconventional spaces, from parking lots to distribution warehouses with paddle courts. On the sidelines of some are saunas and bars where players can mingle between matches. Courts have also opened at upscale malls, including two in the LA area. The Westfield Century City Mall has a paddle club on its roof, while another Westfield in Sherman Oaks has three courts on top of a parking garage. There are some of the now 1,000 or so publicly accessible paddle courts in the U.S., up from about 227 3 years ago. Investors getting in on the action include Gary Shimbaum, a former Tommy Hilfiger executive who has backed a racket sport venture in West Palm Beach, Florida. John Kruger, co-founder of the Bluestone Lane coffee chain, has a New Jersey paddle business of his own. Ronnie Fieg, founder of streetwear brand Keith, made the sport a central component of Keith Ivy, the members-only club he recently opened in Manhattan, which has three paddle courts. Individual memberships cost $45,000 up front and then $10,000 annually. Paddle, a fast-paced sport that shares elements with squash and tennis, is mostly played as doubles. Emily Dempsey, 36, took it up 4 years ago when she moved to Miami from New York. she prefers paddle to tennis because the courts are smaller, making it easier to get to know other players. It's social, it's dating, it's professional, says Dempsey, who runs a networking group for women in the Miami area. She belongs to Paddle X, a club in downtown Miami that costs $212 a month. John Omer, 58, recently teamed up with the owners of a fulfillment center in Indiana to bring courts to a 20,000 square foot section of their building, which still operates as a warehouse. New construction is not affordable these days, says John, founder of the North Point Paddle in Westfield, Indiana. He started the business after a more than 30-year career at Intel, modeling his approach after that of Amil Paddle, a club inside a former distribution facility in the Chicago suburb of Glenview, Illinois. Amil Paddle founder Abigail McCloth, 30, was drawn to the sport after playing with international classmates at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. In countries including Spain and Mexico, where paddle was founded, it is among the most popular sports. McCullen, who opened Almam last year, said that many club owners in the U.S. are betting on paddle mirroring pickleball's ascent. They think that they missed out. Last year, over 24 million Americans played pickleball, according to the U.S. Tennis Association, up from about 4 million in 2020. Like pickleball, paddle has its own professional circuit, which includes the Upstart Pro Paddle League. This year, it raised $15 million from investors and began airing selected matches on CNBC. The league is depending on more courts to generate new fans. It's critically important for us, says Michael Dorfman, its CEO. But the sport is a pricey business endeavor. McCullen says that the cost to install one paddle court can be around $50,000 because of the glass and the other materials for the walls. Construction costs are another factor that differentiates paddle from pickleball, according to Krieger, the Bluestone Lane co-founder and owner of the Paddle United Sports Club in Creskill, New Jersey. The barrier to the entry of pickleball is nothing compared to paddle, he says. And building more courts doesn't necessarily mean the masses will come. Countries including Sweden and Chile underwent mega expansions of their paddle facilities only to experience mass closures after a few years. It involves a lot of culture and community creation, says Evan Brown, 31, the owner of paddle clubs in L.A. and Manhattan. The latter is the courtyard of the Mink Building, a commercial space in Harlem, once used to store furs. If you don't intend to really go out doing that, it's going to be a really hard business, certainly in the short term while the education is still happening. The sport's future also hinges on marketing. Some celebrities, including Eva Longoria and Derek Jeter, have championed paddled ventures. Other notable fans have been more low-key in their support. At Paddle Up in Culver City, Los Angeles, first indoor paddle facility, Coldplay guitarist Johnny Buckland has been among the players, says the club's owner, Peter Wharton. Buckland went unnoticed until the club's general manager asked if he wanted to play in a tournament. He says, "I can't, I'm on tour," Wharton recalled. She's like, "Oh, are you competing?" She says, "No, I'm in Coldplay." The racket sport rundown, comparing key components of paddle, pickleball, tennis, and squash at a glance. The paddle. Instead of strings, paddle rackets have holes in their dense heads. Paddle balls share a color with tennis balls, but are less bouncy. The sport's rectangular courts are 66 feet long by 33 feet wide, divided by a net and surrounded by four walls made of glass panels and mesh. The pickleball, it has the solid rectangular faces of the pickleball paddles, make them resemble pizza peels. Plastic pickleballs look similar to wiffle balls, but with more holes. Courts can be set up on various surfaces, including driveways. They are 44 feet long and 20 feet wide, with 7-foot-long zones known as the kitchen near the net. Tennis. Tennis rackets have large round heads with firm crisscrossing strings. Balls are about the size of a mature orange and the bounciest of the bunch. Courts can be constructed on hard and soft surfaces from clay to grass with dimensions measuring 27 feet wide or 36 feet for doubles and are 78 feet long. For the squash, firmly strung in a griddle pattern, squash rackets have more of an oval shape. Roughly the size of golf balls, squash balls are made of rubber, but have relatively little bounce. Four walls enclose the courts, including a 15-foot-tall front wall. Single courts are 32 feet long, doubles are 45 feet, and all have a wooden surface. From the style page, how to protect your jewelry at home and on vacation. Recent high-profile museum heists beg the question, what can be done to ensure your personal collection doesn't meet the same fate? And this is by Olivia Howe. Marion Fazel was working as a jewelry archivist in New York when her office was robbed in 1992. The thieves took many gems, but the item she missed the most was the Les Mus de Cartier watch they stole off her wrist. As much as the robbery shook Fazel, she wasn't stopping wearing her favorite jewelry out and about. It's just something you have to be careful with, says Fazel, writer of the jewelry newsletter The Adventuring. This month, the theft of some 27 pieces of jewelry from France's Lalique Museum was the latest in a long line of headlining making jewelry heists. It happened less than a year after thieves dressed as construction workers entered the Louvre and stole the museum's prized French crown jewels worth around $100 million. If you invested in a jewelry collection, regardless of its value, such heists might have you wondering how best to protect it. While residential burglaries in the U.S. fell 13% last year, according to FBI data, when they do occur, jewelry is among the first thing burglars look for, says Scott Kinsey, a former detective sergeant of the New York State Police Department Organized Theft Squad, who is now the executive vice president of the Jewelry Security Alliance. Besides cash, jewelry is the number one target. At home, Scott often hears stories of people whose jewelry was stolen from them while hosting large gatherings or having work done at their homes. A burglar's first stop is typically the primary bedroom closet, he says, which is why Scott suggests putting a decoy safe in the closet and storing valuables elsewhere in the home. Chubb Insurance recommends clients store valuable jewelry collections in a safe that is at least 750 pounds, literally with a security rating of TRTL at 30 times X, which protects against professional burglary tools like torches. Fine jewelry should have up-to-date appraisals confirming pieces, specifications, and estimated values. Appraisal paperwork should be stored separately. If jewelry is taken but the certifications are left behind, they can make it easier to recover stolen pieces. Ensuring your jewelry can help the covered cost of if it's stolen or damaged. Most insurance companies estimate that insuring a piece typically costs 1 to 2% of its value annually. On vacation, travelers wearing high-end watches and gold pieces are especially vulnerable to theft, Scott says, because of those items' resale value. When flying, always keep valuables in your carry-on, he added. When Faisal is traveling, she packs individual pieces in small clear bags to easily see them and prevent them from getting scratched. Everyone in the jewelry business does it, she says. If you're out and about, especially among crowds, her tips are to wear long sleeves that can cover watches and to flip around rings so that the diamonds or other stones aren't facing outward. Or you could take a cue from Bryn Walner, a writer and the founder of Dimepiece, a watch website. She suggests traveling with inexpensive alternatives if you're worried at all about your favorite items being swiped. Put your cheap little guys in the rotation, she says. If you're staying at a hotel, it's always worth asking if the property has a private vault where you can store high-value items, says Tanny Nag, vice president of art, jewelry, and valuable collections at Chubb. You really don't want to rely on the in-room safe because it's so easily accessible. And wait to share photos from your trip on social media until you're back. Not only does posting in the moment reveal your location, but it also lets people know that you are not home. You are listening to the reading of articles and features from Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the fitness page, the newest ways to stay cool while you sweat. A new wave of high-tech apparel claims to lower the skin's temperature. And this is by Ashley Mateo. Summer keeps getting hotter, but record temperatures aren't keeping runners from their daily jogs or fall marathon training. A new wave of high-tech apparel aims to help them stay cooler and more comfortable through the heat. For decades, the way to stay cool while exercising was simple. Wear less clothing and make what you do wear light and loose. Now the world's biggest performance brands and a wave of smaller challengers are betting on a new approach. Active cooling technology. Fabrics, constructions, and materials designed to lower the temperature at the skin's surface. Robert Higgins, who researches heat and hydration during exercise at the University of Connecticut Story Stinger Institute, advises that high-tech clothing is fine to try, but isn't necessarily better than letting your own sweat cool your skin. And no matter what you're wearing, he says, anyone exercising in extreme heat need to stop if they notice a higher heart rate, excessive fatigue, or muscle cramps. Here's how the new piece works, plus feedback from runners who have road tested them. The cool head. The graphic cubes in the cap soak up the water and spread it across a larger surface area than your forehead so it evaporates faster, making you feel cooler according to research. It's called the Omnis Cooling Cap, which sells for $234, and it's a regular baseball kind of cap, but it has these graphic cubes alongside the forehead band. My Omnis hat saved my race at the last year's Berlin Marathon, which was in September, where temperatures were unseasonably high. I brought a water bottle to the start line and wet the hat right before the gun went off, then dumped water on the hat at every water station. I still faded, but I ended up finishing with my best results in the three times I've run that course. And this is by Brian, who is 37 and he is from Boulder, Colorado. The cold neck. This is a zipper pocket and a bandana holds up to 2 pounds of ice that drips out through tiny holes in the neoprene fabric as it melts. And you can tie it around your neck and the ice goes in your back of your head. I found it works better than a regular bandana filled with ice. The shape sits better on the shoulders and back, and there's very little bounce. It's a lot more comfortable around the neck. It only kind of feels like I'm being strangled. And this is by Mike, and he's 46, and he's from Crystal Lake, Illinois. And it's called the East Peak Ice Bandana, and it sells for $42. It also is good for when you're doing exercises and then for your cool down. Air Conditioned Core. It's a shirt with different kinds of holes in it. Tiny tapered holes in this long sleeve shirt channel air into the skin with larger cutouts and high sweat spots to keep the shirt light and chafe free. And it's by Nike, and it's called the Radical Air Flow, and it sells for $150. I recently did an interval workout in 85 degrees while wearing this, and it felt like there was a little layer of cool air between the fabric and my skin. It was especially noticeable when a breeze would come by. It felt like someone just turned a little bit of an AC on around my body. I even took it off for a rep to see if shirtless would feel better, and nope, it felt cooler when I had the top on. And this is from Alex, and he's 29 from Westminster, Colorado. Ice cold arms. These are sleeves for your arms. Wet, then wring out and wave around these air arm sleeves before snapping them on. Research shows they provide a sensation up to 30 degrees below body temperature. And they are called Mission Cooling Sun Sleeves, and they cost $20. I bought these sleeves because I'm responsible for leading marathon training runs, so I don't have the luxury of dropping out if I overheat. I soak them in cold water before the run, and in my experience, they provide a cooling effect once activated and stay cool long enough to make a meaningful difference for over 2 hours. They also do a great job protecting my arms from sunburn. And this is Steve. He's 56, and he's from Chicago, Illinois. Here's a pair of pants, and then they're called Fresh Legs. These two-in-one layer short a lightweight shell over a liner that's constructed from cloud-shaped fibers, which boosts the surface area sweat can evaporate from. The lining fabric is extremely light and silky, and once it's wet, the material cools your sweat and becomes like a second skin. It also becomes transparent. You can see tattoos through it, so you really need the light over short to prevent you from looking completely naked. I think it actually works. And this is by Thomas, and he's 55 from Baltimore, and the Satisfy Running Heat Crush 8 desert shorts, and they sell for $285. The verdict, if you need a $150 cooling shirt or $235 cooling cap, when a splash of water and a light t-shirt might get you most of the way there, runners describe a noticeable effect that can be worth it if you're logging serious miles in the heat. But the gear is optional, not essential. Skin exposure is the best means for your body to cool, says Higgins. For those who aren't comfortable running shirtless or want sun protection, a lightweight, sweat-wicking top is a happy medium. From the food and drink page, frozen yogurt is back, but not as you might remember it. Forces driving the latest fro-yo craze include gut health and social media, induced FOMO. And this is by Adam Chandler. You could say that frozen yogurt trends come in crazes, not phases. In the 1990s, fro-yo nurtured a dubious reputation for healthiness, summed up by George Costanza shrieking in disbelief on Seinfeld. How could this not have any fat? In the mid-2000s, buzzy brands like Pink Berry and Red Mango brought froyo back to the forefront with distinctly tart flavors, fruit topping, and celebrity followings. Yogurts from this era often claimed to be fat-free, but had a fair amount of sugar per serving. Now a new frozen yogurt craze is being spurred by gut health, luxury vibes, long lines, and customers posting online about those lines. Driving the interest are several fast proliferating chains that offer probiotic-rich yogurts made with cultured milks that contain healthy bacteria. These yogurts are also showing up at establishments of yore, like 16 Handles and on menus of haute cuisine restaurants like Loopy and Iris in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and the Inn at Little Washington in Washington, Virginia. Probiotic frozen yogurts, which contain healthy fats and more protein than other versions, align with the types of high-protein diets that have taken off with the boom in GLP-1 weight loss medications. That many are offered with highly Instagrammable toppings like fresh honeycombs has only added to their allure at a time when high inflation has led consumers to seek small indulgences. According to the research firm Circana, frozen yogurt servings sold in the U.S. between March 2025 and March 2026 rose by 26% compared with the previous year. Sales of packaged frozen yogurt also increased 24% year over year domestically, according to data from NIQ, a consumer research firm. Among the new guard of probiotic froyo purveyors is Mica, a chain from Madrid that sells frozen Greek yogurt. Founded in 2023, it now has stores in Paris, Miami, Mexico City, and as of this year, three locations in New York City. Earlier this month, at one of its outposts in Manhattan, people were lining up outside in 92-degree heat before the store even opened. Sylvia Hartman, a retired New Yorker in her 80s, had bumped into her neighbors there the day before and was told to arrive early. They said, "Come before it opens, or else you'll be waiting around the corner." Mica's, it's spelled M-Y-K-A. Froyo is served with toppings like extra virgin olive oil, diced figs, Meldon salt, and hazelnut cream mixed with a crunch of katafi, an ingredient made famous by the Dubai chocolate. A 2-ounce kitty cup with a topping like shredded baklava will set you back about $10 with tax. A similar froyo chain across U.S. like Mimi's, Kala, K-A-L-A, Culture Club, and Go Greek. Some customers have said they have paid upwards of $20 for larger sizes and more toppings. 16 Handles, founded in 2008, started selling its probiotic frozen yogurt, a kefir, K-E-F-I-R, soft serve, in January. It and others have come at times when more people, particularly Gen Zers, are replacing alcohol with wellness. The chain, which has doubled its store count in the last 3 years, doesn't open a location with fewer than 25 seats. The let's meet at a bar is just not a thing as much used to be, said 16 Handles CEO Neil Hirschman. That's where a frozen yogurt spot fills a big void. On a recent Tuesday evening, a 16 Handles store in Manhattan was filled with teens idling at tables and charging their phones. Down the block at Anita Gelato, an international chain founded in 1998, that now also has a devoted froyo following, I encountered another line of people. I waited 20 minutes to order its cultured milk frozen yogurt, my second froyo of the day and my fifth that week. My 2-ounce cup, piled high with Anita's original tart flavor, set me back $9. while any line for Froyo is usually too long for this grouchy reporter. After trying versions of Micah, Pinkberry, 16 Handles, and Mimi's, Anita's won out on simplicity, freshness, and a light texture. Others who waited patiently for their Froyo at Anita's included Sydney Ellard, a recent law school graduate in her mid-20s. Ellard, who has upcoming clerkship with the Supreme Court, noted how some of its jurists are also fans. Justice Elena Kagan refers to herself as the frozen yogurt justice and even had a Froyo machine installed in the court's canteen. Jonathan Staley, a consultant in his mid-20s, had returned to Anita after going there recently on a date with his girlfriend. "We've been here before and always had gelato," he said. Then his girlfriend told him about the frozen yogurt. "So I tried it last week, and now I'm back for a second round." From the off-duty travel page, "Can a good massage cure jet lag? These spas think so." Hotel spas around Southeast Asia are developing treatments to address their customers' most frequent complaint, debilitating jet lag. And this is by Stacy Lesto. "Let me know if it gets to be too much," the therapist at Capella Singapore's Auriga Spa, Auriga, said as she ground a copper gusha sha tool into my muscles. She scraped my skin with firm, painful strokes and then moved on to cupping, placing glass suction cups across my back and shoulders. Despite the dim lighting and gentle music, I was nowhere near a state of zen. But total relaxation isn't the point of the new moon massage, around $270 for 90 minutes. After long trips, travelers are increasingly opting not to be pampered, but instead to have the jet lag beat out of them with intense, even painful spa treatments that aim to shock your body into equilibrium by increasing blood flow and stretching out tight muscles. It's widely understood that there's still no such thing as a one-and-done jet lag cure. But after my massage, I felt light and pliable, if also tired and sore. I slept a full night and adjusted to the new time zone faster than on previous trips. I had more treatments that might make a major time change a little more tolerable. The first one is the deep tissue work. At the TIA Wellness Resort in Da Nang, Vietnam, General Manager Ramu Imper steers travelers towards the deep tissue leg recovery included in a stay at the resort. Over the course of 50 minutes, therapists focused on alleviating tension and fatigue in the legs and feet, which often feel the brunt of a long flight. The Four Seasons Hotel Bangkok at Chao Phraya River offers its own version, which uses bamboo rollers to get even deeper into the tissue, and it costs about $190 for 90 minutes. Ashley Kassenbach, a Massachusetts-based physical therapist, says not to expect that one massage will have you feeling yourself after an 18-hour flight. But increasing blood flow, reducing muscle stiffness, and increasing serotonin, a hard massage can take on some components of travel fatigue, she says. Cupping and gua sha. Adherents swear by cupping therapy as a way to massage muscle pain and detoxify. But more spas are touting it as the ideal post-flight treatment. At the Four Seasons Bangkok, targeted jet lag treatments like cupping were introduced in response to guest feedback, particularly around the physical impact of long-haul travel and the need to feel well quickly upon arrival, says Gokpun, its spa director. Often, like in my treatment in Singapore, cupping is paired with gua sha. It's spelled G-U-A. Next word, S-H-A. creating a push and pull on the skin. Jorge Hernandez, director of PA and Wellness at the Capella Singapore, said the technique triggers blood flow, supports the lymphatic system, and calms the nervous system, all helpful in the battle against jet lag. Katzenbeck says the airy feeling I had leaving my treatment was likely linked to temporary changes in fluid distribution, which can make people feel less swollen or heavily, especially after travel. The Thai massage. Those new to Thai massage, popular not just in Thailand, but around Southeast Asia, may be surprised by all of the stretching involved. Over the course of an hour or so, you may be asked to sit up or stand as the therapist uses their hands, elbows, knees, and even feet to move your body through a series of stretches to unlock joints and reduce tensions. This works wonders for Jordan Ashley, the founder of Souljourn Yoga Foundation, who took advantage of Bangkok's late-night spa culture when she was making frequent trips there for work. Ashley said that a Thai massage, which in Thailand can go for just $10 to $15 an hour at some places, is her favorite post-flight ritual. The floor mat stretches acts like assisted yoga, which is incredible for restoring joint mobility after a long haul. At an island resort such as Antara Koyoyai, a 90-minute Thai massage costs around $175 and comes with all the bells and whistles of luxury experience. For some, the premium is worth it, if only for a much quicker that you can get back to your hotel and enjoy a good night's sleep. You are listening to the reading of articles and features from Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Another Off Duty travel, how to enjoy a trip to Saint-Tropez, even if you're not a millionaire. The French Riviera hub is a status symbol for the jet set, but look a little deeper and you'll find a place with plenty of local charm and natural beauty. And this is by Mary Winston Nicklin. For a few summer months every year, a town in the south of France with a year-round population of less than 4,000 lure the world's tech titans, soccer stars, and red carpet regulars. Yachts akin to floating palaces fill the marina. Celebrity chefs jet in for residences at local restaurants, and Pamplona Beach morphs into a sandy catwalk with seasonal beach clubs. Long before the 1956 release of And God Created Women, when Brigitte Bardot drew the elite gaze to this corner of the French Riviera, Saint-Tropez was a port run on shipbuilding and maritime trade. You can still find vestiges of that past in the cobbled alleyways lined with pastel townhouses once owned by sea captains. Areas like those and other places in this guide are part of the quieter side of Saint-Tropez, away from the nightclubs where you don't have to be a millionaire to have a good time. Outdoor thrills. Set on a peninsula ringed by vineyards and natural reserve, Saint-Tropez's surroundings still feel wild, thanks to a 1986 national law that preserves large tracts of coastline. To get a sense of topography, walk 10 minutes from the center of the town to the Citadel, a fortress where peacocks roam, and you'll have panoramic views over the Gulf of Saint-Tropez. Inside the 400-year-old building, a maritime museum, tickets cost about $6, charts the port's history as a launching point for sailing expeditions all over the world. At Saint-Chalier de Litoria, a walking trail that starts back near sea level, skirts the coast around Saint-Tropez for some 25 miles. In spring, the trail is fragrant with jasmine and pine. As you get farther away from Saint-Tropez, the crowds thin. Don't Don't be alarmed if you run into a nude sunbather or two. You can take the trail all the way to trendy Papalona, where sunbeds at the beach club go for upwards of $140 a day. The walk at a leisurely pace takes around 4 hours, or you could stop 2 miles earlier and grab a beach lounger at Les Salines, where prime seaside spots go for about $29. Aquatic adventures. Ships float off the coast throughout the year, but autumn ushers in one of the biggest sailing regattas on the Mediterranean. Held since 1999, Lavoie de Saint-Topaz will take place this year from September 26 to October 4th. Admire the classic and modern boats in the port or sign up for an excursion with Bateaux Verts, which offers ferry rides and boat trips. Taking one during the regatta can offer an insider's perspective of the race, says Pierre Robson, president of the Society of Natural de Saint-Topaz, which organizes the regatta. If you're looking to get active on the water, the Yacht Club of Saint-Topaz offers kayaks, windsurf, and paddleboard rentals from around $23 an hour. Local eats. In the summer, Saint-Topaz can feel like a celebrity cook-off with Michelin-starred chefs seemingly competing for the most popular pop-up. Those restaurants serve elevated fare with price tags to match, but you don't have to splurge on tasting menus to eat well. Away from the crowd is La Vierge de Palan, offers views over the Gulf and fresh seafood, which starters from $25 and an on-site fish market. On the Place de l'Est, the central square that hosts twice weekly farmers market, Scarlet Grand Library is a hybrid bookstore cafe with good coffee and homemade cake. Laura Marins, who has explored every inch of town as director of the Saint-Topaz office for the Majory and Son Real Estate Agency, appreciates its bohemic chic ambiance away from the hustle and the bustle. Marins also recommends going 20 minutes outside of the town for a meal or two in the medieval hilltop village of Ramatoul. She likes the Italian restaurant La Pomme de Pin, the pizza spot Les Will, where slices can be enjoyed under parasol pines, and the 1907 wine bar at the Chateau de Maris vineyard for a sunset aperitif. Affordable accommodations. If you cast your net outside of the town center and consider visiting in the low season, your options for reasonable accommodations multiply. On the coast towards Saint-Maxime, Camping des Mures is a four-star campground on the beach where cozy wood-paneled mobile homes start at around $70 a night. In nearby Gascine, listed among the most beautiful villages in France, rates at La Bastine Antoine Hotel drops to $250 in October. If staying in the heart of town is non-negotiable, you'll find the occasional deal. Right on the Place de l'Est, the Hotel Les Palmiers offers 25 rooms in a traditional provincial building set in a garden. Rates start at about $137 a night in low season and top out at about $345 in the summer, a bargain compared to other hotels in town. The Hotel Subi, overlooking the port, low season rates start at $285 a night. Its nautical theme bar regularly draws locals at sunset for Negronis. It's a timeless spot where you can appreciate the charm of the old port as the light fades, says Robeson. If you're there for the regatta, look out for an appearance from the parish priest. Before Lavaux, Father Goen conducts a traditional blessings of the boats from the balcony. From the food and drink page, two easy-to-make spritz cocktails you and your friends will love. Both of these summer cocktails harness the refreshing quality of the elderflower liqueur. And this is by Odette Williams. Every year, a large group of my friends gather for a big summer feast at my place, swimming, chatting, and cooking up a storm. At last year's shindig, my friend Chet created a refreshing spritz without any of the cloying sweetness of Aperol. I've been making it ever since. Its key ingredients, the elderflower liqueur, is also in Hugo Spritz, but those are made with Prosecco, while Chet's Golden Hour Spritz uses gin and bitter liqueur. Its bubbles come only from club soda. The drink is perfectly balanced, the ideal summer sipper to get you buzzed, but not bombed. Elderflower liqueur is also the star in my spritz riffing on the Greyhound cocktail, which combines gin or vodka with grapefruit juice and club soda. The liqueur has a touch of sweetness that counters the tart grapefruit. I love topping it with Topo Chico for the soda's minerality and extra fizziness. Serve either spritz or both. Each take 5 minutes to make with olives or an antipasto plate, or if you rather order in a couple of pizzas. You make a bottle of elderflower liqueur, go farther, and add a splash or two to fruit desserts with like strawberries or grilled stone fruit. The Golden Hour Spritz. To amplify the flavor and gold hue, an aged amber Old Tom gin works best. Takes 5 minutes and it makes one drink. The ingredients: you need 2 ounces of lemon juice, 1 ounce of Old Tom gin, 1/2 ounce of elderflower liqueur, 1/2 ounce of bitter liqueur like Tempest, Fruget, Grand, Colosso, club soda for topping, a lemon twist for garnish. The directions: fill a highball glass with ice. Add lemon juice, gin, elderflower liqueur, and bitter liqueur. Top with club soda, stir, and garnish with a twist. Enjoy. Here's another. It's called the Greyhound Spritz. If you fall in love with this pink spritz, a vintage hand-cranked metal juice-o-mat citrus juicer extracts just the right amount of pulp to juice ratio. You can find many online. Juice-O-Mat Citrus Juicer. It takes 5 minutes and again, one cocktail drink. Ingredients: 2 ounces of fresh grapefruit juice, 2 ounces of vodka or gin, 1 ounce of elderflower liqueur, club soda for topping, a lime wheel for garnish. Fill a highball glass with ice. Add grapefruit juice, vodka or gin, and elderflower liqueur. Top with club soda, stir, and garnish with a lime wheel. Enjoy. You are listening to the reading of articles and features from Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From another food and drink page, not all pasta primaveras are created equal. Make this one. Here's a simple pasta featuring spring vegetables that you want to make all season for yourself or the crowd. And again, this is by Odette Williams. Not too long ago, a reader wrote to me asking how to make a truly great pasta primavera, an Italian-American dish from the 1970s. Too many primavera recipes are weighted down with large, unwieldy chunks of vegetables that have absolutely nothing to do with spring, the season that gives the dish its name. Carrots, tomatoes, peppers, and squash have all been bad for the primavera brand. Luckily, farmer markets this time of year are full of spring produce that are right at home in primavera. Asparagus, snap peas, chives, leeks, and fresh herbs. Throw those into the mix and you'll have a dish that actually tastes like the season. It's so simple to cook at home and the end result excludes an effortless elegance that will make you want to invite friends over. The first step is to saute leeks in garlic and olive oil, butter, and crucially, a bit of white mismo. I love Meran, a white mismo that adds umami without taking over. Your kitchen should fill with a buttery, nutty, garlicky aroma, which means you're on the right track. Add the asparagus and let everything turn glossy for a few minutes, and toss with sweet snap peas, chives, and al dente pasta. Finish with a generous dollop of ricotta and shower with freshly grated Parmigiano. To make it a party, serve some good crusty bread and salt-flecked butter on the side, along with a bottle of crisp Californian or Italian white wine. Here's the recipe: pasta primavera. Perfect for a casual spring lunch with friends or night with when the vino flows. Blanching the asparagus and snap peas keep them bright green. Let the pasta cool slightly before tossing everything so the vegetables stay crisp and vibrant. Takes about 30 minutes, and this serves between 4 to 6 people. Here's your ingredients: kosher salt, a half a pound of tender asparagus trimmed, a half a pound of sugar snap peas trimmed, 7 teaspoons of extra virgin olive oil divided, 7 tablespoons of unsalted butter, 2 tablespoons of light miso, 1 large leek, white and light green carrots, thinly sliced, 2 cloves of garlic minced, 3 tablespoons of finely chopped chives, plus more for garnish, 1 pound of penne or any short dried pasta, freshly ground black pepper, fresh ricotta for serving, Parmigiano Reggiano for serving. Directions: blanch the vegetables. Prepare an ice bath. Bring a large pot of lightly salted water to a boil. Add asparagus, snap peas, blanch until crisp tender about 1 minute. Using a spider or slotted spoon, transfer straight to the ice bath for a few minutes, then drain and pat dry. Keep the pot of water over low heat for the pasta. Slice off the 2 to 3 inches of asparagus spears, finely slice the remaining stalks. Slice the snap peas on the diagonal in thirds. Sauté the vegetables in a large frying pan over medium-high heat. Warm 3 tablespoons of olive oil with butter and miso until melted, glossy, and combined. Add leeks and garlic and sauté until softened, about 4 minutes. Add asparagus stalks and tips and sauté 2 to 3 minutes. Remove from heat and mix in snap peas and chives. Cook the pasta, return the pot of water to a boil. Add pasta and cook according to package directions until al dente. Reserve a half a cup of pasta water, then drain. Transfer pasta to a large mixing bowl and toss with remaining 4 tablespoons of oil. Let pasta cool slightly so it doesn't wilt the vegetables. Stir and saute vegetables, add reserved pasta water. Season with salt and black pepper. To serve, divide among bowls. Top each serving with a generous dollop of ricotta, more chives, cranks of black pepper, and finely grated Parmigiano. You've been listening to the reading of articles and features from Saturday, Sunday, July 25th, 26th issue of Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal. We read from Off Duty every Saturday at 8 p.m. Your reader has been Patricia Mary. Thank you for listening. God bless and be safe out there and stay cool.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have Sports Illustrated. At 10 o'clock, we have The Athletic, and at 11 o'clock, we have episode number 13 of Kin by Tayari Jones. Stay with us. The following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org. Hi, everyone. This is Jim Kohler, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the August issue of Sports Illustrated. It's all on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Okay, I'm going to start off this brand new issue, which is featuring Jalen Brunson from the New York Knicks. He's on the cover holding up the championship trophy. He's all in blue with a white champion.
The following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability,